I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. One of the highlights of my Broadway pilgrimage in January was a celebration of the music of composer Stephen Flaherty. The show was presented by the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music in the Stern Auditorium at Carnegie Hall. Flaherty is an alumnus of their renowned musical theatre program. Stephen Flaherty is, of course, the prolific composer whose work in the musical theatre, in partnership with lyricist, librettist Lynn Ahrens, includes iconic titles such as My Favourite Year, Once on This Island, A Man of No Importance, Seussical, and the masterpiece of musical storytelling, Ragtime. For me, there is no other composer writing for the contemporary stage who has such command of style and construction of a musical language that places us in a distinct world. The shows he crafts, with Ahrens, each embrace and elicit the world in which their narrative unfolds. Such is his prodigious talent. I am therefore thrilled that he is my guest today in this special episode of the Stages podcast. I guarantee you'll be a fan too at the conclusion of our conversation, and will be keen to sample as much Ahrens and Flaherty's writing for the musical theatre as you can access. Dear listener, it's a great thrill to introduce to you Mr. Stephen Flaherty.
You'll get an acknowledgement. So we're recording?
Yes.
Right.
The AI lady just let me know that.
AI is everywhere. Has that crept into your consciousness and awareness yet, being a composer?
Yeah, you know, a lot of writer friends of mine and actor friends, obviously, it's a very nervous-making time, you know, because it's a time where a lot of it is being used now in the industry, you know, and it's like somebody could say, like, you know, write a Stephen Flaherty score, but make it, you know, and then add one other word. And it would be sort of almost, my guess is what I would do, but it wouldn't have a soul, you know? And I think we have to hang on to our souls and our humanity, personally.
Absolutely. And hence we see that big actor's strike, which took place recently in Los Angeles and Hollywood. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not being replaced by AI. Well, first of all, Stephen, I have to send you big love from Caroline O'Connor.
I love her.
I first
met her, I think it was like, geez, it must have been like 1994 or 5 at a Christmas party at a company called Imagination that was in London. They were producing Once on This Island in the West End at the time. And I just remember them saying, like, this is the it girl. And I just remember loving her, and I held on to it. We didn't get to work for like another 20 years, but it was worth the wait. She's fabulous.
She is indeed. I checked in with her this week just to ask her, did she have a memory of working with you? Because, of course, she did Anastasia with you at the Hartford stage, and then, of course, on Broadway. And she recalled a time, I think in Connecticut, where it was one of the first sings around the piano. She and John Bolton were doing a duet, and Terence McNally was sitting at the side eating. She said he always ate.
he always ate, and he always had dessert with every single meal that he ever had, you know, like even breakfast, you know. That's true.
Fantastic. But Caroline was saying the thing she remembers is you beamed the absolute joy from you and Lynn Ahrens, your writing partner, hearing that duet for the first time. Because I guess as a composer, the voice finishes your work in a way.
Very much so.
But that must be an eternal delight for you to see an actor, a character, come to life, whether it be a countess or a prize fighter like Rocky Balboa.
Absolutely. And as a composer, I totally count on the input of my actors and their talent and what they bring to the piece. You know, and I love people in general that are inquisitive, but actors especially. And Caroline and John just brought such a crazy sense of playfulness. And we basically, once, you know, we had the tune going in, but we sort of built the number around the two of them. And it was constantly morphing and changing. And, you know, in a weird way, we and the director wound up being their editors, like saying, that part's good, keep that, no, get rid of it, you know. But it was very a very much a group effort with those two. And they're just a delight. And hearing certain actors sing the material after a while, if you've cast the part really well, you begin just to hear not only the character, but them as the character. And it makes my job so much more delightful and easy and fun.
It must be interesting also seeing different productions with different performers bring life to your score.
It's great. And also new directors and new slants on it. We Lynn and I were in Tokyo. It's the first time either of us had been there this past September, and there was a new production of Ragtime in the Japanese language, and there was also a new production of Anastasia that opened up 4 days later. And the Anastasia production was pretty similar to the Broadway. It was like what we would call a replica production, but the Ragtime production was fabulous, and it was told through the eyes of Tata, who's the immigrant character in the piece. And I had never seen that take on the piece in any other production before. And so it felt really, really fresh. And it was interesting because there was a Japanese director, and I guess he saw himself as the outsider to this quote unquote American story. And so Tata is the one main character in that piece who's an outsider, and also he's the one that's creative, you know. In act one he creates he cuts paper, and act two he cuts film. So the idea of cutting and combining and making a story out of your life was this amazing new concept that they had put on the piece without changing a word or a note, you know. And it was just really exciting to see another culture bring and this group of particular artists bring their take to the piece.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, Stephen, Benji Stone, a character that you're very familiar with, has a favorite year. Do you have a favorite year? Not your best year, not the year you had the most success, but a favorite year.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, maybe it was when I was 14 and I wrote my first musical. That was the most fun I had ever had in my entire life. And I wrote it at my high school, and my friends wrote the book and lyrics. And it was the first time that I had ever seen anything of mine up on a stage. And it was thrilling. And at that moment in time, I thought, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. So that was a good year.
What did the young Stephen find to write about in that first musical? What was it about?
Well, it was ridiculous. From Siamese twins and faith healing. And it was sort of a spoof on Guys and Dolls, and it was set in my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So it was like ridiculous, but and super fun. And each scene was set in a different neighborhood of my town, and each song was written in a completely different musical style. So it was like very like genre based. And I wrote each song in a different color of ink So it was just very playful, and just the idea of collaboration with people that I love was wonderful. And that's what I kind of want to keep doing until I can't. So that's what I'm up to.
Well, we talk about you being a composer, but you are, then you're talking about crafting character and story.
Yeah.
A dramatist, really, aren't you, also?
Well, that's the thing. You know, people always talk about, you know, what is the difference between a theater song and like a pop song? And they think I'm going to talk about style. And in fact, really what it is I'm a dramatist and my language happens to be music. So I have to find the music that conveys the emotion, the place, the time, who the character is, and just basically illuminates emotionally and in all ways what this character is going through. So if you were hearing a song that was, say, in the Polish language and you didn't know a word of it, you could still understand what is being said, even though you don't have the particulars of language. So that's been something that has really driven me. And I try to talk to a lot of younger writers about that, about how music is a storytelling, a way of telling our stories and a way of saying, this is who we are, this is what we sound like, and this is what we feel strongly about.
What genre of music do you like listening to?
All kinds. All kinds. We were lucky that whenever I grew up, we had an amazing funk and soul station in Pittsburgh, and my parents couldn't stand that kind of music, so they would give me the car keys, and here I am as like a 9-year-old kid in the driveway turning on the ignition so I can listen to the radio, you know. And I that was sort of probably my first love. And then bit by bit, you know, I learned classical music, and then I worked a summer in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was learning country and Western. And I worked as one of my jobs in college was I played for a ragtime band, believe it or not. And this is like 1980 or something. And I got to learn all of that material. It was all of the dance music from America from 1890 to 1920. And then I would work in archives and do all sorts of research. And I listened to a lot of film scores. And I'm just listening to the gamut of music, you know, and because I find it all interesting. And I just want to, well, the thing I love about music is you can never get to the bottom of it. You know, you can only scratch the surface. So I want to expose myself to as many different kinds of music as I can.
I would have assumed that it would be eclectic tastes in music and listening.
Oh, definitely.
And I hope you take this as a compliment. There are a lot of musical theatre composers where you listen to a score and you recognise that as the composer. I can spot Cy Coleman, who wrote a whole range of scores, whether it be the operetta of On the 20th Century or the jazz-influenced City of Angels. Every score he wrote, The Life, every score he wrote sounded completely different. And I think that of you also, whether it be ragtime of ragtime, the rock of Rocky Balboa and that story, and Anastasia is almost operetta in a way as well, but there is a distinct style through each piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, actually, Rocky was a challenge to me because it's a very working class Pennsylvania story. And, you know, we were thinking of like the old play. There was a series here in the States called Playhouse 90, and it was like very sort of gritty, dramatic plays that were then put on television. So I really wanted it to be that kind of thing. And I started imagining my neighborhood watching the show as I was writing the show, because I didn't want it to be like Phyllis Scanlon up the street. I didn't want her to say, "What's that? That's too fancy." And I was trying to like be very direct. And that was oddly really challenging to like simplify, like, oh, that's too much. Like, let's get to really down to the basics and, you know, get in that world of rock and, you know, get heavy hitting. And it wound up being a wonderful opportunity. We had the best time because we were over in Hamburg, Germany, where we premiered that show. I know, in German. And like Stallone came, you know, and nobody bothered to tell him that it was going to be in the German language. I'm like, how did somebody miss that, you know, miss that memo? But it was like a real odyssey for us, our little group of Americans, and we were making theater in Germany for 3 months, and then we brought it back here. And you know, we had a really wild director, and it was just the pleasure of creating that show was wonderful. And Anastasia, that was one of the rare opportunities where we got to write for these characters for the film version, which was 97. And then I think it was 2017 when we were in Hartford, where we got to revisit these same characters and deepen the story and rethink it and flesh it out. And, you know, the challenge is, after all that time, it's not even just trying to match what the rest of the score is going to be with, you know, those couple of original songs, but just finding your way, you know, because you're different in every decade of your life. And so I'm trying to think, gee, what was I feeling when I was 30, you know, and writing that movie? And and I thought, oh, is this going to be hard? Is this going to be weird? And believe it or not, it was really easy. It was effortless. And we just jumped right in there. And the operetta like quality of it, I really wanted to bring that out a little more. And and we were working with our friend Terrence McNally, of course, and you know, he's a delight. It was wonderful.
It would seem that any subject can be given a musical treatment, but I guess yes. The characters have to sing. You have to find some key to open that. What do you look for when somebody suggests a subject to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The second show that we did with Terrence, we did three shows with Terrence, the first being Ragtime, the second being an Irish show called Man of No Importance, and the third being Anastasia. So Man of No Importance, it was a beautiful independent film that I loved very much. I think I'm one of the very few people that actually saw it in a theater.
Albert Finney.
Albert Finney, Brenda Fricker, Rufus Sewell, Tara Fitzgerald. It was a beautiful film, and it was about friendship and the making of art and coming out into the world and being yourself. And the only thing that was super hard, and oddly, the main character is probably the closest to me of any character that I've ever written. So you would think, oh, that'll make it really easy, right? But no, the thing that was really tricky is that the character is very guarded about showing his cards, you know, and letting people know who he is. And he's very secretive. And I just could not get music out of him. I said to Terrence, I said, I'm really struggling. And this character is really interesting to me, but he has no scene partner and he's not talking to anybody about what is important to him in any page, you know? And I said, I'm really having a hard time getting music. And so the next day, I think Terrence came back and he had written this wonderful new scene where Oscar Wilde, who is mentioned in the movie, but who is not in the movie, all of a sudden is in Alfie's room. And he's like sort of like his imaginary friend in some strange metaphysical way. And all of a sudden, Alfie is able to speak to Oscar Wilde and he's able to pour his heart out. And the minute that I had that in front of me, the entire show came out. It was also the only song we ever played for Terrence. And after he heard it, he goes, oh my God, that's the sound of our show. It was a song called Man in the Mirror. And then he said, will you play it back? Can I hear it again? And he's never said that ever about any song in any show. And once he said, can I hear it again? I just knew that I had musically hit the center of what we were trying to do. So it was easy, but I couldn't do it by myself. You know, that was Terrence coming up with that really smart idea to help out his struggling composer friend.
yes, musicals offer a sense of magical realism, if you like, where you can bring in other imagined characters like that, or back in the origins, the dream ballet. Have you ever had a dream ballet in a show?
Well, we have a major ballet at the end of a show that we're working on called Little Dancer. We did it at the Kennedy Center. And then again in Seattle, Washington, and I don't know if I can say this. Oh, why not? Okay, we're going to be doing a big concert in the West End in London this fall, and we're going to do like a couple of performances, and the entire piece is set in the world of ballet, and it's about the relationship between the artist Edgar Degas and the young girl who became his muse for Little Dancer, age 14, the statue. And it's about an older artist and a younger artist meeting at one moment in time. And we were Lynn and I are doing it with Susan Stroman, who's directing and choreographing. And the whole reason to do it was, besides working with Stro, who I had never worked with, it all culminates in like a 10-minute ballet. And I just thought, let's go for it. Let's do that. And I'm excited. So it's going to be a concert performance, and it's going to have ballet in it. And our young star from the United States, Tyler Peck, is coming over with us. And she's an incredible artist. And I'm really lucky to have her in my life.
What was that like writing dance music? Because course, there are no lyrics to tell the story, but you are effectively telling the story through a musical language.
Yeah, I first, in general, I don't like dance arrangers, I have to admit. You know, that's maybe because I'm trying to control, you know, my score, but in general, I get sort of grumpy around them. But I had a young director choreographer named Christopher Gattelli. And he sort of gave me a dare, which I just thought that sounds scary and exciting. So I said yes, to do a dance musical with him that would be 10 short stories all on the same topic, which was romantic destiny. And he found 10 different playwrights, and each of them wrote a different dance scenario. And it could be set in any culture, any time. It could be farcical, it could be tragic, you know, it could be whatever they wanted it to be. And then Chris and I then set out, and I was the one composer setting these 10 different worlds to music. And it was a challenge because I could no longer lean on words, you know. And at the beginning, I tried to cheat a little bit. I thought, oh, well, maybe this can have a song in it. But the further I got into it, I just thought, let's really try to tell the story with music only and with the physical body and imagery. And it took us quite a long time. We worked on it for a number of years, because for each of these tiny little pieces, it took the same amount of research that it would take me, you know, for an entire musical. But the idea that you could be 10 different characters and tell 10 different stories was great. So after that, it sort of emboldened me. And for Little Dancer, I am collaborating with the one dance arranger who I love, believe it or not. And his name is Sam Davis, and he's a wonderful composer in his own right. And we just have a wonderful time together. And he feels like my brother, you know. We just love hanging out, and he's just really terrific. So,
Well, effective collaboration is such a big part of making theater, isn't it?
That's the thing that I like, you know. And there are a lot of people that are what I would call solo artists, you know, a lot of people who go in the studio and they come up with the concept of what the musical world is, and it's their own voice and their, you know, multi-tracking instruments and all of that. And I think that's cool. I just find it incredibly lonely. I just love to work with other people. And I really realized this during the pandemic when I was away from people, you know, and I was like in my, you know, like we all were, you know, we were in our little Zoom squares and, you know, in our own little worlds. I just missed sitting with people and throwing ideas off them, you know, and I realized like when I'm at my best, I think I'm a responder. I think I need other people, and I think I need other viewpoints, and I count on it, and it inspires me, and it takes me in different directions other than, you know, myself sitting by myself in my room, which is, you know, that can only take you so far, I think, or at least my room.
Stephen, you moved to New York City in 1982 and joined the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theatre Workshop. Can you explain to the listener who Lehman Engel was and what the workshop was?
Yeah, Lehman Engel was a very celebrated Broadway musical director. And this is back in the day whenever the Tony Awards gave awards to music directors, which they don't now, because I don't think anybody fully understands what the job of a music director is. But Lehman Engel won his Tony Award in the 50s for conducting Leonard Bernstein's Wonderful Town. And he wanted to create a launch pad for writers who are interested in writing for musical theater. So writing, you know, musicals and hybrid musicals and, you know, all of that. And he got the BMI company, which is like, do your listeners know what BMI is, or do I have to explain that?
No, explain that one as well.
Okay. It's like they collect royalties for, public airings of your song. So anytime you're in an elevator, watching a television, listening to a radio, streaming something, and you hear one of the songs, they collect that royalty money for the writers. And they were mostly like sort of a pop place. And Layman came to them and he said, you know what, I want to encourage theater writing. Can you help me fund this? And they did. And I met Layman when I was a sophomore in college. He came to my alma mater of Cincinnati, Ohio, and he wanted me. Well, it was great. It was just a lucky coincidence that he was going to be doing master classes for the music theater performers there. And while he was there, he says, oh, are there any writers, any musical theater writers? And I just happened to be in rehearsal for a show of mine. And my best friend at the time, he was also in rehearsal. So we were like the two lone musical theater writers in Cincinnati, Ohio. And we played him some of our stuff and he critiqued it. And afterwards he said, I think you're really talented. I think you should drop out of school. I think you should come to New York. I think you should do that immediately. And then during that period in my life, I was into completion because I felt like I was oddly self-taught. And I just thought, no, I have to like finish these 2 years of school so I can feel like I'm a real composer as opposed to like somebody, you know, faking it in the real world. So I said, I'd like to come and when I'm in New York, I'd like to drop by, but I can join in 2 years. So to cut to the chase of this story, the week before I moved to New York City, when I was 21 years old, I picked up Newsweek magazine and it said died Layman Engel. He had died the week before. And so I was like frantic because I had in my mind based my entire rest of my life on being in his workshop and being with this man. And so I called up BMI and I said, I just read that Layman had passed. I'm really sorry, but is the workshop continuing? And the man who was the business side, who was running BMI, said, oh yeah. He said, but you have to audition. And I said, oh great, I'm happy to do that. When are the auditions? And he said, today at noon. And so I'm calling from Pittsburgh, PA at 10 in the morning. And I'm like, oh my, and I don't know if it was because I felt a sense of destiny that I was supposed to be there or a sense of panic or a sense of whatever it was. But I said to him, I said, you know, I can't get there in 2 hours. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but you have to accept me sight unseen because I fully believe I am supposed to be in that workshop and Layman wanted me to be there and I need to be there. And there's a big old pause at the end of the phone. And he said, okay, just don't tell anybody. And so that is how I got into the workshop. And that's where I met Lynn Ahrens. And I had never worked with anybody else before. You know, she had written music and lyrics, and I had just written music and lyrics by myself. She was actively looking for collaborators. I sort of was new to the city. I didn't even fully know what that meant, you know, honestly. And we were working together within 6 months, and we've been working together for 40 years. So there you go.
Can you remember that very first meeting when you laid eyes on each other and what was that like?
I was very timid. You know, I was like a really timid kid, you know, and so I was just kind of doing my thing very insularly. But I admired her work from afar, but I had never approached her honestly. And she could put in five good words. She could condense very complex ideas into like five or six words where it would take me like 30. and I just admired her and I was dragging my feet. I don't know why, probably because I was, you know, shy. And it was the last assignment that year. And I was walking down the street. She was walking in one direction. I was walking in the other direction. And the hairs in the back of my neck stood up and I thought, turn around. And I turned around and I screamed down the street. I said, hey, Lynn, do you want to work on a song? And she goes, oh, okay. And that was the first song we wrote together. And I can't say the song was good. Well, you heard it at the Carnegie Hall concert. That was our first song. I can't say the song itself was good, but the process of writing the song was fantastic. And she was very much an improv girl, you know, where she would work in pop music and throw ideas around. And I was very much like a very serious mad monk who would put myself in a cloistered way, you know, and think profound thoughts until notes appeared on the paper. And I think I was good for her, and I think she was good for me, and we wrote completely differently. And I think it really shook everything up for both of us. And it felt like a great experiment, and wound up being like, oh no, this is like the first of many days for the rest of your life. So it was great and is great.
I imagine the marriage over the years, those different styles have blended a little bit, or do you still write very differently?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think she freed me up. And at the time, whenever I was a very young writer, I was very aware that, you know, when you're writing a piece of music, you come to a fork in the road, and it's like, do you make a left or do you make a right? And I would not make a choice. I'd freeze up thinking, oh, if I go to the left, it'll become this kind of a piece. If I go to the right, it'll become this kind of a piece. And her way of freeing things up was like, just make a choice, and you'll find out soon enough whether it's the right choice or the not right choice. And so just the idea of her sense of playfulness and her firm belief that the more you wrote, the more you basically did your thing, other ideas would bubble up to the surface. Like, she had this incredible sense of faith that there's more where that came from. And, you know, and I found out that there was, you know. And at the same time, she had never written for theater before. She had written in the pop world. She had written jingles. She had written copy, you know, an ad agency, but she had never written dramatically. So I think I had, that was sort of my jam. So I really, I think, helped her along with that. And she became much more of a theater person and much more of a dramatist, you know, the further we went into it. You know, she was always a great songwriter. And the fact that she knew music and had written music, and the fact that I had written words, was great, because we became one another's editor, you know. And, you know, and you just have to be really honest and free and able to throw out your idea, whether it's a good idea or not a good idea. And you have to treat one another with respect. And, you know, that's sort of the basis where you build from.
There's been a lot of change since that BMI workshop in 1982, as far as the repertoire of musical theatre, which was very much at that time the book oriented musical. Yeah. Whereas, you know, in recent times we've seen shows like Fun Home and Avenue Q, Floyd Collins, Passing Strange, Caroline or Change, which continue to play and reinvent the form.
I think that's essential, and I think. You know, finding new people to collaborate with, that's really exciting. And, you know, I try to go with people whose work I admire, and, you know, and just see what bubbles up. We're about to embark on a new musical, and it's the first time I've ever collaborated with a band, and it's a Mexican band. And I'm so excited, because I've always wanted to be part of a band, and here I am just starting out in my 60s, and I've never been in a band, and I just thought, I am super interested in this, and why don't we just do it? And these artists are greatly talented, and it's a Mexican story, and I have a residence in Mexico, and I love the land, and the culture and the people, and I've wanted to do a piece about Mexico for a very long time. So unlike Once on This Island, where I'm, you know, a kid from Pittsburgh imagining what a Caribbean island is, I'm collaborating with this group of Mexican musicians who are greatly gifted, and it's their culture and it's their land. And, you know, I'm going to bring my music out through them, and, you know, we're interfacing, and we had a little workshop, and I can't talk too much about the piece, but talk about magical realism. It is all through it. And it's a completely different way of me working. And I'm thinking it's all guitar based, you know, and I'm a keyboardist. So everything about it is super exciting, something that I love, and something I've never done before. So we're off to the races.
it's good to be stretched in different ways and to take risks and be challenged.
I think it's necessary. You know, I was working on this dance musical that I had mentioned to you with Chris Scatelli, and we had a Dramatists Guild council meeting here in New York City, and the guild is basically represents all the composers, lyricists, librettists, and playwrights. And I'm on council, and for some reason at this meeting, they had assigned seats. And to my left was Stephen Sondheim, to my right was Stephen Schwartz. So they're like three Stephens in a row. And I knew that Sondheim was on the verge of going into rehearsal for Roadshow, which is the show that he had begun in the 50s. And now here we are, and it was like, you know, the 2000s, and he was about to go into rehearsal with that, with the director John Doyle down at the Public Theater. And I said, "How do you feel about that?" And he goes, "Oh my God!" He says, "I feel like we have to get this done," you know, because he'd been dragging this show along with him for like 40 some years. And he said, "What are you working on?" I mentioned the dance musical, and I said, "I'm really super excited by it." I said, "But I'm sort of frightened by it because I don't know how fully I can pull this off yet, you know, because there was one piece that David Henry Huang, the playwright, had written, and it was about modern day Shanghai and a techno club, and then a guy takes a drug and a drink, and he goes back to it was Peking opera in the Ming Dynasty, and like and with swords and kabuki. I mean, all of this, I didn't have a handle on any of this, and I said, I just don't know how I'm going to pull this off. And Sondheim looked at me and he said, "That is so great." He said, "You are so lucky." He said, "We should all start not being very excited, but not knowing what we're doing." He said, "Because that means you haven't done it before." And he said, "The challenge is dealing with, you know, your fear. You know, it's like if the excitement of it outweighs the fear, then you can go forward." And he said, that's always the challenge. And he said, "But that's so great that you don't know how you're going to execute it, because you'll find out." And he was absolutely right.
After working with Lynn for so long, you have done a couple of shows with Frank Galati, Loving Repeating and Knoxville. How did that challenge you adapting to a new collaborator?
Well, we actually met Frank first with Ragtime, because he was the original director, and he just passed actually like a year and 2 months ago, and he, you know, I think of him daily. He was such an important part of my life and our lives, and the thing that was so great about him is he was always the smartest person in a room. You know, he just was, and he would share that knowledge and that excitement. And his favorite thing was literature, and he would look to great works of American literature, and he would adapt them for the stage and dramatize them. And that's actually what he teaches. He was a teacher for probably more than 30 or 40 years at Northwestern University. So that was his specialty. So we had seen his production of Grapes of Wrath on Broadway, which was brilliant. And so that's why we thought of him for Ragtime, because he had never done an original musical. He had done opera, he had done drama, he had adapted works of literature, but he really respected language. And so first on Ragtime was Terrence, and then Lynn and I, and then Frank. And he became a lifelong friend. He was just so... he just took delight in what he did. And I just, every moment I spent with him or near him in the room with him, I just felt like I became a better person, you know. And he would challenge me, and he would support me, and he would laugh, and he just really was an amazing force, you know. So after that, we wound up doing Loving Repeating, which again was I think that was my first time not working with Lynn, and my collaborator was Gertrude Stein, and every single word in the piece was something that she had written, whether it was a speech or a letter or a piece of fiction. And so Frank adapted this, and he doesn't use a typewriter, let alone a computer, if you can believe that.
Wow.
So he gave me this script that was written in longhand on a yellow legal pad. And I was going out of town and taking the bus. And so it arrived as I was running to get on that bus. So I brought it with me, and he didn't indicate where a song would begin, where a song ended. It was just sort of this thing. And I just thought, again, I don't know. I don't understand this. I don't know how to do this. And yet I was intrigued by it. And there was a something that had a little more story to it towards the end. So that was the first thing I started working on. And I thought I had been working on it for maybe like 20 or 25 minutes, and I had been working on it for 5 hours. And I was just like totally down the rabbit hole and into that world. And I just thought, okay, shit, I have to write the rest. I have to write the rest of this now, don't I? And trying to get into it, you know, Frank, who's also an actor, which was also really interesting. He said, you know, there are these recordings of her reading her pieces. He said, they're very, very eccentric. And I said, oh, that would be so helpful just to hear her voice, because she was a character in the show, hearing her voice reading her words. Where can I get these? And he goes, oh, they're really hard to find. So all of a sudden the light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, well, Frank, you're an actor. I said, can you play Gertrude Stein and just read your entire script into a cassette, you know? And he said it took him the entire weekend to do that. And his partner, Peter, helped him and taped it. And once I had that, I understood it. And he, when he would get to what he felt was a crucial word, he would stretch it out. Then he would go quickly, and then he would go to another word. And it just sort of, I don't want to say I copied his line readings, but it really helped me understand the language and her sensibility and where the ideas were. And so it was a wonderful experience. We did it at first at Northwestern University with students. So there was an adult teacher, you know, there, and she was Gertrude Stein, and everybody else was 21 or under. And he said, I feel that people misunderstand Gertrude Stein. I see her as so playful. And he said, everybody treats her like she's esoteric. And he said, I just want to do something with young energy. And I want it to be playful. And I want it to be celebrating language and theater. And there was a scene originally where he had Gertrude and Alice B. Toklas making a salad together. And he said, and making a meal should be as important as making a poem or making a piece of art or making a piece of music. And so with that, I just wrote the entire thing in a summer home that we used to have. We've since sold it, but my partner, now my husband, he and I were there, and I wrote it over the summer. It was just, and the entire piece was just filled with juice and pleasure and joy. And I wrote one song while I was swimming, and it was a very short song. And I said to the cast, I said, you know, if I were a better swimmer, this would be a much longer song. But just the sense of joy. And I stayed on campus and lived in Chicago, Illinois, and I orchestrated it myself, which was the first that I had really done that for a new show. And we used student designers, student musicians, student actors, and it was a joyful experience. And then we got to do it, like, you know, in the fancy place. We did it at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. And it was one of these like sort of mixed media pieces. It wasn't fully theater, and it had visual art, and it was like a real changing point for me in the way I saw things. So yeah, Frank Galati he's, you know, I was going to say the word finish, but we're not. I was working on it today. We did a show called Knoxville, which is based on James Agee's A Death in the Family. And Frank adapted it and directed it. Lynn and I wrote the score. And when Frank passed, we knew that we wanted to continue. And so he said he felt strongly that if we were to continue with this, that Josh Rhodes, who's a wonderful director and choreographer, who was our choreographer, he wanted Josh to take the mantle. So Josh has, and this whole week has been about jumping back into Knoxville. We're doing it in Knoxville, Tennessee this fall. Wow. And it's super right material, you know, and also because Frank's passing midway through the creation of this, you know, it's about losing things you love and trying to use that grief or pain or whatever you want to call about it to create something of beauty. And, you know, I lost my mom this past December. And so I was writing on her birthday and I was trying to work on a new piece about this that was about knowing what love and grief are about. And I have her picture right there, and I just looked at her and I said, "Oh, this is really tough. This is really rough." And I just hung in there and hung in there, and I had a piece of music at the end of it that I liked, and you know, she inspired it. So
that's fabulous. I guess in writing, you can experience forms of catharsis at times, also when and use your life to sort of infuse in your music, yeah. Invest in your music,
right. I was just talking to a composer friend of mine, young composer, and we're getting together next week. And I said to him, he said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "You know, I'm doing okay. You know, it's like emotional flares up and down all the time." I said, "But, you know, aren't we lucky that we do something where we can take all of this crazy emotional stuff and that we have a place to put it and that we can actually transform it into something else?" And, you know, you can't do that if you're an accountant, you know, but being a composer, and he said, "You're so right." He said, we're so lucky that we're able to have, you know, a place to do that and a means to take something that feels messy and give it order and give it meaning. And if you do it really well, somebody else will hear it and take that conversation further, you know, and I think it's extraordinary. We're just really lucky to be able to do that.
Let them hear you.
Yeah, that's right. You know it.
Well, let's talk about Ragtime. To me, I would venture to say that the two great musicals which bookend last century, A Showboat by Kern and Hammerstein, which really kicked off the musical theatre as a form, and finishing with Ragtime at the end of that century. Two shows which aren't dissimilar in their themes and their epic storytelling. But I think it's wonderful that those two pieces have bookended the century. You had to audition for Ragtime, I believe.
Yeah. You know, I was so excited to be able to have that opportunity. You know, and there were friends of mine, and they said, "Oh, weren't you insulted?" Because at that point, we had already had two shows on Broadway and some off-Broadway work. And I thought, not at all. I just thought, I know I can do this. I know we're the team to do this, and we just have to have the opportunity. And the fact that it was like a weird sort of bake-off of composers and lyricists vying for the opportunity to do this show, I thought it was a wonderful chance. And I remember reading in the New York Times when they said that these producers had gotten the rights for the novel Ragtime, which I loved when it came out. And I just assumed, oh, well, you know, one of the big guys is going to get that one. And whenever they opened up the field, I was on fire. And I just said to Lynn, I said, "We just have to go for broke. We just have to go for this." And we counted on our hands. It was a busy time, too. We counted on our hands. We had 11 working days to write four songs, music and lyrics. And then I had to arrange them. And then we had to go in the studio and I had to play them, orchestrate them on the keyboard, do the vocal arrangements, invite actors in, record them, mix them. And we were working in a studio that had no automation. So it was our engineer and Lynn and myself, and we were each operating like, you know, four faders, and it was, and there was no time to second guess yourself. You know, you literally had to just go with your first gut impulse and keep going. And we decided, you know, just to be expedient, that Lynn would write two songs lyrics first and I would write two songs music first. And at the time I was in London, I was working on Once on This Island's London cast album at Abbey Road. And so I wasn't even in the room. And so she would send lyrics, and it seemed like an impossible time, but you know, honestly, that was maybe my favorite year.
Yeah.
You know, if I got two favorite years, because that was the definition of really connecting deeply with something, going for broke, being on fire, not having enough time, all of that. And it became this amazing 3-year experience as we got the show, worked with Terrence, met Frank, got to mount it in various, you know, various venues, and then open it on Broadway, and then to cap it off, you know, we won the Tony Award for our score.
Well, it is the most magnificent score and the most magnificent show. I was lucky enough to see the Broadway revival in 2009, and it's the only show that I've seen that I went back the next night to see again. Sure. I just, it was captivating.
Well,
I remember.
It's interesting. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember the curtain rising, and they had the three tiers of the different ethnic groups. The audience just rose and there was thunderous applause, and the company had to wait, I think, 4 or 5 minutes before they could start the show because people were so delighted to see this show back on Broadway.
I know it was astounding, you know, and the, well, see, that's the other thing, you know, because the show became, depending on when it was done, it was a completely different experience because, you know, we had written it and produced it on Broadway in 1998, but that production that you mentioned in 2009, we had done it at the Kennedy Center, and Barack Obama was our president. You know, so all of a sudden it was a show about hope, and look how far we've come. Okay, then cut to 2016. You can see where this is coming.
Yeah.
And I got married because I thought, you know, we might have a dictator in our White House and he might take away my rights and I have to protect myself. So I got married. We went to London. We had with Trevor and I sort of had our honeymoon there. And we saw a lovely production at the Charing Cross Theatre, which was an actor-musician production and a scaled-down production. And it was the week before the election. And so I was feeling a sense of hope and, you know, but there was, you know, rumbling in the wings. And so then we went back to the U.S. and Donald Trump got in the White House. And we were stunned. And then Lynn saw the show the next week. So I saw it a week before the election, and Lynn saw it the week after the election, and we saw completely different shows. What it meant to her was completely different than my experience. And so now there's talk about, you know, maybe bringing it back to New York. So, you know, we're excited and keeping our fingers crossed because I think we've gone way back in history. We went forward, then we went way back. And, you know, all the themes in the show are really topical and really timely. And I'm excited to see the discourse, you know, that happens when people see the show now and in the present day. You know, it's going to be something to behold, certainly.
Garth Drabinsky was the...
The
key man there, the impresario from Canada, who really got Ragtime off the ground and going. Can you tell us about Garth? What was Garth like as an impresario?
He was larger than life. He was like a David Merrick kind of, or a Ziegfeld character. You know, he was, I think it's super interesting, by the way, that you mentioned Showboat, because, you know, when we had our audition tape, you know, which was back in the day, we had cassettes then, you know, I had to give my cassette over on the opening night of his Broadway production of Showboat. And he, in his mind, had thought this is going to be a trilogy of like great American stories. He produced Showboat, then Ragtime was after that. And then at the time he was developing Parade with Jason Robert Brown and Alfred Uhry. Right. So it was so interesting, you know, going to Showboat, handing in the cassette. And then I thought, well, the die is cast. I am just going to enjoy my party, enjoy this show, and we'll see what happens. And the interesting thing about Garth is he really cared about the work. He really cared about the artists. I saw him picking up candy bar wrappers in his theater because, you know, he just wanted everybody to have like a perfect experience. And he was passionate, and he would micromanage. And I remember saying to him at one point, because I was just getting so many notes, and I said, you know, I can learn as much about what I need to do in this show if you tell me what you like as opposed to what you do not like. And it threw him for a loop. And, he cared deeply, but yet at the end of it, you know, for the people that know this story, is, you know, he had two sets of books and, like, you know, he went to jail as the punchline of that story. And we knew something had to have been up because the experience, we thought only once in our lifetimes are we going to have this experience. And I had written a symphonic suite based on the themes, and we did it live at the Hollywood Bowl You know, with the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, and we recorded it, and it was the bonus track on our CD. And I thought, and our conductor said, "How is he paying for this?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "I have no idea." I said, "But aren't we the lucky beneficiaries to be here at this moment in time?" And you know, everybody thought, something's amiss," and it was, you know. But to have been given that opportunity was incredible, you know. Of course, I felt for all the people that he took down the rabbit hole, you know, when he became a publicly traded company, and he took their, you know, their mad money, and you know, they didn't get it back, you know. So, so artistically, really challenging, and the rest of it is the rest of it.
Yes, Bialystok and Bloom have nothing on Garth Drabinski. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, exactly. He's, yeah. Yeah, totally.
So from Ragtime, you go to a very different topic in the stories of Dr. Seuss with Seussical.
Right.
Such a contrasting focus on your work.
Well, it's interesting because there's something about watching your lead character get shot to death every night for 3 years that it's like, it's sort of, it builds up like some of this intense residue. And a lot of what we've done has to do with what we just did or what happened before. And we had heard that Garth and his company had obtained the rights to all of the Dr. Seuss books, you know. And they were interested in potentially creating a musical based on that. And I said to Lynn, I said, you know, I actually think it would be wonderful just to do something more playful, something that's literature based. This had a strong visual style to it. And, you know, after doing all my research for Ragtime to try to make it feel like this is what this time and this year and this moment in American life was, I love the idea of having no rules, you know. All of a sudden I'm writing for like the jungle of Newell, you know, and I thought, oh, this could be an urban jungle. This could be all of the kind of music that I loved when I was 9 years old sitting in that car. And this could be like jazz and funk and soul. And then Whoville, I thought, oh, they could be like Spike Jones, those comedy records that we used to hear as kids. And I thought all of this could be really playful, really fun. And also artistically, it was kind of challenging because like Ragtime, it was a multi-storied piece and we could use any of these characters, and they could meet one another. And it was sort of had a playful, really playful, fun start. And we were developing it with Eric Idle at the beginning from Monty Python. And there was something about sitting with children's books and reading them aloud to one another, Lynn and I and Eric, it was wonderful. It was joyful. And in our very first reading, we didn't even have a director at that point. It was just Lynn and I and Eric, you know, at the helm. And we had a music director. And we just cast all of our friends in these roles. And Eric himself played the Cat in the Hat. And it was great fun. And it took me some convincing to convince Lynn to do this, because she had done a lot of children's TV and, you know, she had just done like this very serious dramatic. And I said, you know, I think it's a really creative challenge and it's a completely different muscle. And, you know, I had to convince her, frankly, to do Ragtime as well. So there's certain ideas that I just think these are too good to not do. So let's figure out if we can do them or how we can do them. And she's been the same with me. Like if she has a passion project, she'll keep at me until I say yes. So that was the beginning of Seussical. Yeah, it was like Mickey and Judy in a barn put on a show. And that was our experience.
Fantastic. You wrote a piece called The Glorious Ones, which was performed at the Lincoln Center. The character of Flaminio, the Commedia troupe leader, has a song called I Was Here. Just to quote some of the lyrics, I say we yearn to leave something that lasts, to be known for what little we've done. Men tell their children the tales of their pasts, and each man gives his name to his son. Well, I will not flicker and die like an ember. Too many men flicker and die. I will leave something behind to remember. Somehow I must. Don't ask me why. Now, your legacy is enormous, Stephen. People will be performing, companies will be performing your musicals for the next hundreds of years, I'm sure, I know. Oh. What are you proudest about of that legacy?
Oh, you know, that's asking, like, who is your favorite kid? You know, who is your favorite child?
Yeah, well,
like,
not a favorite show, but yes. What have you enjoyed most about being a composer and creating these works?
Honestly, it's a very simple thing. The thing that I love is at the end of your writing day, if you have something that didn't exist in the world at the beginning of your writing day, that's a good day, you know, because... Yeah. Just seeing, I mean, because it's a mysterious thing, you know, people keep wanting to, so how do you write? And it's something you honestly can't pin down, and it is mysterious. And I'm glad that something in the world still has mystery. And I just love the process of writing, and I love how I feel physically when I'm writing, because after a while, you know, you become the character. It sounds like kind of spooky, but you do, you feel who that person is, who that being is, what emotionally they're feeling. And oddly, I'm just sort of hanging out, like waiting for the music to come. I am sort of like the midwife, or I don't know, like it's the music comes from somewhere else, and I just happen to be sitting in front of a keyboard or sitting in front of, you know, a computer screen, and my job is to capture that. So it sort of comes through me, but I don't know where it comes from, but that is the most exciting thing, you know. And it's fun, of course, to see audiences respond to it, but the genesis of it, how it feels, that, and that's like the best. That's a really great day. And I think if you have a couple of great days and string them together, then, you know, it winds up being a career if you're lucky.
Well, continued triumph to you, Stephen, with Little Dancer and the Mexican show band. We can't wait to see what that is.
I know. Me neither.
It's been a great honor to speak to you. So thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Peter. It's been my pleasure. And thanks for having me. And it's good to know that there is a lot of people who love musical theater down under. And I can't wait to come back to your great country and have another adventure.
That was such a special conversation to include in the Stages archive. Such a treat, such riches Mr. Flaherty has given the musical theatre. Please check out all and more of the Aarons and Flaherty canon at www.aaronsandflaherty.com. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.